The next assignment will be from this book called The Pageant of the Pope, written by John Farrell. It has the imprimatur of the Bishop of Los Angeles. And the book appeared about 20 years ago. The copy I have here is the sixth printing in 1945. I believe about 5 years ago at Gimbel's over here in Cheltenham at Christmas time, they must have had 300 of them in paperback for sale. It's been published by Roman Catholic publishing companies and has been widely distributed over the country. So that it is not Protestant propaganda. It is a book published by Roman Catholics giving the history of the priest, of the papacy. And so it will naturally be prejudiced somewhat in that direction. But I think that taking an interest in that subject, it is good to get what those say who are prejudiced for it rather than against it. And so we will have some assignments from it. They will be posted within the next day or two. Here we have a comparatively few absence now, but at 5 after, half the class was not present. And we should start promptly on time. Next time, please be here before it's 5 after. I was told the clock in the hall is 3 minutes faster than this one. At that rate, everybody should have been here 2 or 3 minutes ago. I'm going to have to do one of two things, either to give a quiz at the beginning of the hour, right sharp at 5 after, which I don't think I'll do, or else to mark down 2 points on the semester's mark for everybody who is late after this. Well, I hate to do that because then some will just stay away and miss it altogether. That's much worse. Maybe it'd be better to simply count two tardiness as the equivalent of an absence. Maybe that would be better. We'll do one or the other for sure. But now, yesterday we were speaking about number nine, the 11th century. And under that, we notice a political event. And from a political viewpoint, the conquest of England in 1066 by William the Conqueror is, in the history of England, from a political, cultural viewpoint, of tremendous importance. From the viewpoint of church history, it is not one of the great events of church history. It did result in the Saxon leaders of the Church of England being replaced by men who were Norman French. But that also affected the cultural life of England greatly, but it did not greatly affect the religious life. And so we only deal with it here because it is one of the great events in English history, and it's good to have an idea of when it happened in this 11th century. Number two, we notice that France, like the rest of the continent, was still in the feudal system. And the emperors had the line of Charlemagne had gradually died out in the course of a century and a half. It split up among various grandsons, and gradually divided up, and none of the men inherited any of the genius of Charlemagne. The system of hereditary taking of positions is one which has rarely been valuable, except from one viewpoint, that it often maintains a certain steadiness in that you don't have a conflict and war when a man dies to decide who's going to be next. That's the only advantage of it. Usually it has resulted in inferior men succeeding men of ability. And the line of Charlemagne died out or lost its power completely, but we noticed Hugh Capet, in a minor count in France, managed to get the title of king. And the title carried practically no power with it. But he had his descendants, there were a succession of rather shrewd men who tried to gather power over other parts of France. And by skillful marrying their daughters, or managing when another line died out to get one of their sons in his place and so on, they gradually gained control over France. But much more important for our church history is number three, which I will call Germany and Italy. I suggested calling it the Empire, but I think perhaps since It's mainly with Germany and Italy and the regions between the two, which we today call Switzerland and Austria, that we have to deal under this head, that we will call it that instead of calling it the empire. This is the part of the remnants of the old Western Empire that was not under the control of the Mohammedans, as Spain was, or that France and England were sort of separate from them. There was never much effort to extend control over them. But Germany and Italy were very much under the feudal system. There had been the effort to establish back in the 6th century, to establish a Germanic kingdom over Italy under the East Goths, but the Pope had called in the help of the Byzantine Empire, and though that movement had gone forward very vigorously for about 30 years, he had succeeded in bringing it to an end, wishing to be himself the leading person in Italy. Then the wild Lombards came in, but during the course of 2 centuries, they gradually became civilized, and their leadership had shown leadership ability, and it looked as if they would get control over Italy and make Italy into one kingdom, like England became under William the Conqueror, in which there would be freedom of movement and safety throughout the country and one control. But we remember that the popes prevented that by getting the Franks to come in and stop the power of the Lombards. And the Lombards were pretty well cut down by the Franks, eventually by Charlemagne, leaving the Pope the leading authority in Italy, but by no means in control of more than a small region around Rome. And so from then on, after the destruction of the efforts of the Lombards to establish a unified control in Italy, right up to 1870, we have Italy divided into many little sections, each of which claimed absolute sovereignty, and each of which had absolute control over its own area, but was apt to be frequently fighting with the other regions near. Theoretically, part of the Roman Empire. And if you had a strong emperor, some allegiance might be paid to him. Theoretically, part of the Christian world, which was thought to be in some way under the spiritual direction of the bishop of the great old capital city of Rome. But Italy during the 9th, during the 10th and 11th century was largely in the hands of small, petty tyrants who ruled over certain areas and fought with one another. And we saw the terrible degradation of the papacy, which resulted when they put their own brothers and sons and relatives into the position of Bishop of Rome during the 10th century. Well, at this present moment, we're interested in the political situation rather than the religious. And our title was Germany and Italy. We find that in Germany, the situation was somewhat similar. In Germany, you had a very large area in which there were many people who were had very little of civilization and who were fighting and attacking their neighbors and looting, while you had a very considerable number of people who wished to live peaceful lives and to develop means of getting some kind of a decent livelihood from the soil and from their work. And these people being constantly subject to attack by marauding groups found their safety in going to the strongest person in the neighborhood and giving him subjection. And thus you had your feudal system in which your local people gave subjection to the strongest person in the neighborhood, and then these men gave subjection to the strongest one in a larger neighborhood and so on. And you went up through several gradations until there were 5 or 6 main sections which differed from one another somewhat in language and somewhat in customs, somewhat in background, but there would be a leader of each of these sections who would call himself a duke. And these dukes felt that they were all Germans and there should be a unity among them, And when the descendants of Charlemagne had lost their power, they had proceeded to elect one of themselves as their head, as their king. And we notice how in the previous century, in the 10th century, Otto the First, the Duke of Saxony, decided that if his power as king were to be anything more than nominal, he should get the support of the spiritual head of the what remained of the Western Roman Empire. And so he had gone to Rome to get the Pope, to get the Bishop of Rome, to crown him as emperor. And you remember how he found that in Rome the bishops were a succession of wicked men interested only in their own pleasure, and of course receiving letters from other parts of Europe which some of their clerks would answer, and they exerting a certain influence throughout Europe, but in general simply enjoying the income that they had, and constantly subject to being murdered by some other group in Rome. So Otto the First in that century had established a pope in order that he might make Otto emperor. And Otto wanted to have the pope be a man who would have respect. And so for a little while in the 10th century, the German emperors, as they became called, claiming to be emperor of the Roman Empire, of the Western Roman Empire, succeeded in putting in rather decent men as popes, but as soon as their army would be withdrawn from Rome, the local people would kill the man and would put in some local brigand, perhaps, and call him pope until the German army would come back again and would put in another German or Frenchman. And at the end of the century, an emperor had put in Sylvester II, Gerbert, the man who had so criticized the papacy previously. Now in this century, we're looking still at Germany as a political here under A3. In this century, the Saxon dukes, who had had the position of emperor for nearly a century, the line began to weaken, and the different dukes, when they came together to elect a new one, elected one from a different part of Germany, a section called Franconia, and is a name taken from the old Franks, as you see. And they elected a very able man named Henry III. Henry III became he's the second of the Franconian line, but they elected a very able family, which the second was Henry III. And they succeeded in establishing a certain amount of unity in Germany, but with tremendous difficulty. Constant fighting, uprisings against them, and in order to buttress their power, they were anxious to have a strong spiritual power that would be respected. And so they took an interest in strengthening the spiritual power and also in getting popes, the title of emperor. So it became customary and continued for the next 500 years that whoever these various dukes elected as their leader would be called the King of the Romans until he would go to Rome and get the Pope to crown. Then he would be called Emperor, the Roman Emperor. And this meant that during the next 500 years, every German king had to go to Rome with an army. And that was a long, difficult trip in those days. And it had enough force with him to establish himself to be crowned emperor. And if he didn't, he was just king of the Romans. And this was a great increase in the necessary labors and efforts of those who would be emperor. Even when we get to Martin Luther's time, we still find the same situation. Yes?
Sylvester II. Yes.
The German emperor, Otto III. Yes. The now we just glance at number four, the Eastern Empire. During this century, the Eastern Empire continues much as it was during the previous century and during the following one. The at Constantinople, the emperor claims to be the Roman emperor, but his power is tremendously cut down by the Muslims. At the same time, he feels his superiority over any of these these neophytes from the West, and his power was very autocratic in Constantinople, so the Bishop of Constantinople, unless he was a very able man, is quite in a secondary position. But the Emperor and the Bishop of Constantinople carry on correspondence with the Bishop of Rome and are always anxious to show that they are at least equal to the Bishop of Rome. And so, as far as our history is concerned, one event of very great importance took place during this emperor, this period that we will look at later. But now we will turn our attention to the papacy. And so capital B will be the papacy. And we find that in the papacy, the situation seemed as if it would permanently continue just about as it had been in the previous century. You remember that we read about the terrible wickedness of John 12 in the previous century. And we read from McSorley in this Roman Catholic history, in which he made the statement that John the 12th was, with the exception of Benedict 9th, was the very worst of the Pope. Well, when you read about John the 12th, when you read about his debauchery, his immorality, the murders he carried out, the utter lowness of his character in every way, you wonder how Benedict 9th could be lower. But McSorley says, except for Benedict 9th, John the 12th was the worst of the popes. Well, early in this century, we find the very lowest point of character in the papacy in Benedict 9th, the son of a petty Roman noble who managed to get control of the city for a brief time, constantly fighting against other nobles. Benedict was only, I believe, 10 years old when they made him pope, and with the arms of his relatives, they supported him in the position, but he was interested only in his own pleasure, and his ideas of pleasure were very, very low. His election, some say, was a mere money bargain between his family and the clergy and populace of Rome who paid, who accepted bribes to elect him. Schaff says of him, this boy pope fully equal and even surpassed John 12th in precocious wickedness. He grew worse as he advanced in years. He ruled like a captain of banditti, committed murders and adulteries in open daylight, robbed pilgrims on the graves of martyrs, and turned Rome into a den of thieves. These crimes went unpunished, for who could judge a pope? And his brother Gregory was patrician of the city. At one time, it is reported, he had the crazy notion of marrying his cousin and enthroning a woman in the chair of St. Peter. But the father of the intended bride refused unless he abdicated the papacy. Desiderius, who himself later became pope, shrinks from describing the detestable life of this Benedict, who, he says, followed in the footsteps of Simon Magus rather than of Simon Peter, and proceeded in a career of rapine, murder, and every species of felony until even the people of Rome became weary of his iniquity and expelled him from the city. They elected another man as pope, but Benedict soon came back and displaced the other man, and then an arch-presbyter in the city of Rome, a man of high character and of considerable wealth, felt that he had must find some means of improving things, and so he asked Benedict IX to sell him the paper. And Benedict IX agreed to sell it to him for a very large sum of money. And so this man, John Gratian, paid a large sum of money to Benedict IX, and Benedict IX resigned the papacy and turned it over to him, and he took the name of Gregory XI. This is told about by Farrell in his book. He says that this was the supreme simony of all time, he says. The papal office was sold. The word simony, by the way, is a word that is much used in church history, in Roman Catholic sources, to describe the sale of church offices. It derives from the book of Acts, where Simon said to Peter, offered Peter and John money to give him the power of giving people the Holy Spirit. Yes? Yes. Now, here is this book with the imprimatur of the Roman Catholic bishop, which describes it rather fully, toning it down only at certain places. And I think that will be very interesting for all of you to see how they do explain it. It'll be very interesting. But incidentally, I would recommend, in dealing with a Roman Catholic, don't ever go to a Roman Catholic if you're discussing this particular thing and say, there is a book which is published by a Roman Catholic press which says that a Pope did such and such, such and such and such and such. Don't ever do that. If you do, there's always a way to get around it. Say, there a Pope did so-and-so, present it simply on your authority, not the authority of anybody. And then when he says, of course, that's just crazy Protestant propaganda. There's not a word of truth to it. And so on. Then show him the book. But if you find it desirable to enter into that sort of discussion, and there are times when it is, though it certainly is not the principal way to approach a Romanist. The principal approach should be with the gospel, of course. But there are times when it is necessary to go into these points, and when it is, that is a far better approach to the matter. Because the Romanists used to try to deny most of these facts. And McSorley says that many Romanist writers have tried, a later pope, Alexander Borgia, have tried to do away with the statements about his character and so on, but he said they now recognize that it is impossible to defend Alexander Borgia. He was later, and they don't think of him as in the category with these men. He was a far more able man than these men. But in recent years, they simply admit the fact. And Pharaoh has the most wonderful argument at the end of his book. He says, we've seen what wicked men, what low men, what weak men have occupied the position. The whole institution certainly would have died out long ago if it were not a divine institution which God kept alive. You see, that's one way of getting around the fact that any human institution is going to have fall into decay and have it's apt to have inferior men occasionally in it. The only reason we're particularly interested is that there's those who claim that God has ordained this position to be the head of his church, and that these men have the right to rule his church because of being Bishop of Rome, and even since 1870 that they are infallible in their teaching. It is simply in view of that claim that there are occasions when it is necessary to show that that claim is utterly unhistorical. And therefore, it should be no these facts. But what I'm interested in more now than seeing the depth into which it sunk is to see what brought it out of it. And that is very interesting. Because the papacy never again after the 10th century sank into as great weakness as it was in then. I personally am quite convinced that the terrible wickedness and degradation of the position in the 10th century, when it was simply a plaything of different petty Roman brigands, would have resulted in its losing all respect throughout Europe, and it would have ended as an institution with any important claims if it were not for the intervention of the German emperors and for what they did. And I don't think they could have done it by themselves. I think other forces entered in to help them. And that we want to look at this morning. But we're now looking at this Benedict IX, and he sold the papacy. And Pharaoh says, for a large amount of money, Benedict resigned and attempted to convey the apostolic succession to John Gratian. Attempted to convey the apostolic succession, you notice the term. Actually, all writers agree that Benedict IX was about as wicked a man and as low down a man as has ever lived on earth, and that Gregory VI, who this man to whom he sold the papacy, was a man of very high character. But here we have this wicked man attempting to convey the succession for a large sum of money.
Yes?
Is this Gregory 9th?
Gregory 6th. Did I say 9th? Well, just divide it by 2. Gregory 6th. Yeah. Gregory 6th. Incidentally, Gregory 1st and Gregory 7th are two of the very most important popes in all history. And this is shortly before Gregory 7th. This is Gregory 6th. Pharaoh says here was a situation to stun canonists, for there was no law to vitiate such a transaction. Actually, the practical-minded citizens of Rome sighed with relief at the new accession, for John Gratian, now taking the name of Gregory VI, was a pious and good man, who, along with many others, had been appalled and shocked by the misdeeds of Benedict. Disdaining such means so common to the age as the dagger or poison, he had resorted to gold to remove the criminal presence, is in this book published by Roman Catholic publishers. He says, to remove the criminal presence before further chaos ensued. Once installed, he began reform, and to assist, he called from his monastery a zealous and clever Benedictine named Hildebrand. Their labors were promptly obstructed by the reappearance of the antipope Sylvester, who, backed by one of these groups of Roman brigands, loudly called upon the faithful to deliver homage to him as the true pope. To complicate matters further, Benedict, whose word was as doubtful as his morals, decided to revoke his resignation, and, surrounded by soldiers, loftily announced that, of course, his had been the only valid consecration. So there were three popes, Pharaoh says, each guarded by his soldiery, holding court in a city whose lawless streets were now not thoroughfares, but skirmishing grounds for ruffians and brigands. And the result was that the German emperor came down to Rome to try to straighten up the mess. And when he did this, he found that the only possible way was to get rid of all three. Gregory VI was a man of high character, everybody agreed. But he had received the papacy by paying for it. And therefore, he had one of the greatest crimes at his account that any man could have, even though he had done it for a good purpose. And consequently, you could not have the papacy respected if the man who was Pope had received the position by paying for it, and everybody knew it. And so, under the circumstances, the thing they decided to do was to have Gregory VI preside at a meeting at a town about 25 miles north of Rome, and there they declared that Benedict IX had twice resigned, and he certainly then was not to be considered as Pope, that Sylvester III was a mere intruder, had been elected by the people of Rome when there was a Pope in power. And then he said, I, Gregory Bishop, servant of the servants of God, do hereby judge myself to be removed from the pontificate of the Holy Roman Church because of the enormous error which by simoniacal impurity has crept into and vitiated my election. And then he said, is it your pleasure that so it shall be? And they unanimously replied, your pleasure is our pleasure, therefore so let it be. And so he descended from the throne, divested himself of his pontifical robe, and implied pardon on his knees for the usurpation of this position. And now the problem was to get a worthy pope in his place, and the German emperor, who had made this possible by his army, proceeded to call a meeting for the election of a new pope, and they declared they could find no Roman clergyman who was free of the solution of the pollution of simony and fornication. And so the king descended from his throne and presented a German bishop, a man of spotless character. And they all called out unanimously to appoint him as pope.
And he crowned Henry as emperor then at Christmas. But he only lived for 9 months. And after 9 months, Benedict IX managed to get power again. Henry had gone back to Germany, and Benedict again seized the power, but he just became so ruthless in his treatment of everybody that soon he was murdered. And so the emperor in Germany appointed a man. And he appointed another German bishop, a man of noble birth, fine appearance, considerable learning, and unblemished character. And he appointed him as bishop of Rome. And now a new factor enters in. I read you just a word that John Gracian, when he was pope, called a man from one of the monasteries named Hildebrand to become his leading supporter. Now this man, Hildebrand, is one of the most important men in the whole history of the papacy. H-I-L-D-E-B-R-A-N-D. Hildebrand. And Hildebrand stood with Gregory VI there. And when Gregory VI resigned the papacy, Gregory VI went up to Germany where he would be safe. The emperor's power was sufficient there, and also not claiming to be pope anymore. He had nothing to fear up there, while down in Italy, having had the position, his life would have been in terrible danger. But Hildebrand went with him up to Germany. And Hildebrand became acquainted with things in Germany. Hildebrand was a man who had been, he was a Benedictine monk, and was connected with the Cluny Reform. You remember the Cluny Reform had started shortly before 1000. It started in France. And it was a movement which, from the monastery in Cluny, had gradually spread to monasteries all over Europe. Most of the ecclesiastical positions of any standing in Europe by this time were in the hands of secular officials, because the abbey, many people left their property to the abbeys or to the various aspects of the church, and so they had acquired very large property, and in order to protect this property, whoever held it had to do homage to the next higher feudal authority. And so these men were not only supposedly spiritual leaders, but they also were men who executed important political power. And the emperors often put, and the kings and dukes often put their own relatives into these positions. And some of these were good men, others of them were men who were purely political men, and some were definitely wicked men. And the Cluny monks were very much disturbed about the condition of the church and anxious to have the church's spiritual power recognized as independent of the political power. And so the Cluny people were now in something of a quandary. Here was Rome, whose bishop, they thought, if you had a good man as bishop, he could exert an influence to improve the church all over Europe. And they were anxious to have a good man as bishop. But the bishops of Rome for the previous century and a half had been very largely these wicked men put in by the local officials of Rome, the local groups that were fighting against each other. They wanted to have it purified. But they didn't like to have this done by having him simply appointed by the German emperor, and like the Bishop of Constantinople was, pretty much just the whoever the German emperor wanted to have in the position. They felt that he should be independent of control by the political leader. And so Hildebrand, very, very cleverly, worked out a scheme to do this. And how well it worked is one of the marvels of history. Because within a period of 50 years, we find the position of Bishop of Rome from a position which seemed doomed to disappear in a few decades because of the terrible depth of degradation into which it had fallen, being lifted to a position in which it had most tremendous power all over Europe. And it was largely through the great the great interest and the cleverness of thinking and the careful planning of this monk Hildebrand. The German who had been made Bishop of Rome had been killed in Rome. German Emperor appointed in Germany a German bishop to be Bishop of Rome. And he was said to be a man of noble birth, fine appearance, considerable learning, unblemished character, full sympathy with the spirit of reform, and accepted the appointment in the presence of the Roman deputies, subject to the consent of the clergy and people of Rome. And he invited the monk Hildebrand to accompany him to Rome. And Hildebrand refused at first, because the man had not been elected by the people of Rome, or by the clergy of Rome, but by the secular and royal power. But Bruno, the bishop here in Germany, said to him, he said, "Well, what do you want to have happen? Do you want the papacy to sink into utter degradation, have a succession of men like Benedict IX? Wouldn't you rather see me than any of them?" "Yes, I would much rather see you," Hildebrand said. But Hildebrand said, "The papacy should not be subject to the emperor." And so Hildebrand made a suggestion. He said, "You dress up in rags, wear the dress of a pilgrim, go barefooted and weeping, enter Rome as a pilgrim to Rome, and seek the election by the Roman people and the Roman clergy." And, of course, the Roman clergy and people knew that the emperor's army was right near, and the emperor wanted this man to be, had already appointed in the presence of their representatives, him to be Bishop of Rome, and they knew that the safest thing for them to do was to elect him. But he came in asking their election, and not claiming anything from what the emperor had done and what the emperor was trying to do with force. And so Hildebrand came with him, and Bruno came in barefoot and weeping and dressed as a pilgrim, and the clergy and people there held a meeting and unanimously confirmed his election. The papal treasury was empty, things were at a very low ebb, but he chose Hildebrand as his subdeacon, financier, and confidential advisor. This was in 1049, and from 1049 to 1073, 24 years, whoever was Pope, Hildebrand was the real leader, organizer, and director of the papacy, and then in 1073, Hildebrand himself was elected as Pope. And so there came a tremendous change in the position through the power, through the force exerted through the arms of the German emperor, but done in such a way as to go through the form of having it be a free election by the Roman people, and with this bishop of high character bowing before the Roman people, asking them to elect him, and thus making it seem to be utterly independent of the power of the emperor, who nevertheless had sufficient troops there to make it either that or chaos, and as they'd had before. And so you now have a group of emperors. This Bishop Bruno took the name of Leo the IX, and he was very important in some of his acts, some of which we will look at under the next head. But he was, when he died, he was succeeded by another man of similar character, but Hildebrand was the real power in the papacy up to 1073. And then in 1073, Gregory Hildebrand became Pope and took the name of Gregory VII. Now, historically, in between, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There were 5 popes between
when Leo IX died in 1054 and when Gregory VII became pope in 1073. There were five popes, but Hildebrand was the real influence during this period. And Hildebrand becoming pope in 1073 and being pope for 12 years under the name of Gregory VII. He deserves the name Gregory the Great, beyond Gregory I. Gregory I and Leo are the only popes who are generally called the Great. And Gregory and Leo were overtopped by four times as great as anyone else who was Bishop of Rome up to Gregory VII. And whether Gregory VII was as good a man or as able a man as these might be debated. But as to his influence on history, he was far greater. And he left an indelible stamp upon the papacy. He made great, tremendous claims for the power of the papacy. And I think most writers feel that he did it not simply through desire for personal power or personal glory, but with a real desire inspired by the reforms of Cluny to have the church be a respectable organization that could exert an influence for good and that would not be subject to any secular power. But he made the most extreme claims that anyone made up till 1870, and he was able to quite an extent to carry them out. And being willing for these 25 years to be in this subordinate capacity and simply advising, and then himself for 12 years being the pope, the pope papacy never again sunk to what it had been just 40 years before and what it had been during the previous century. Now, I did not give you subheads under capital B, the papacy. It is a flowing history of events. It's rather hard to know just how to make it into subheads, but perhaps we might say, number one, Benedict IX, and number two, renewed German intervention, and number three, Hildebrand, Gregory VII, Hildebrand, Gregory VII, and number four, Canossa, number four, Canossa, C-A-N-O-S-S-A, and Bismarck, at one time, less than 100 years ago, when Prince Bismarck, who was the real ruler of Germany, though the so-called emperor was the figurehead and power at the time, and Bismarck was laying the foundations of the modern German empire as it was before 1914, a very able man, when he came into conflict with the Roman Catholic Church, and a situation arose in which people wondered whether he would completely submit or whether he would feel he had power enough to go on. He said, "I will not go to Canossa." And so you see this word Canossa came to represent something definite. Actually, it's just a little castle in the Alps. A little castle in the Alps near the border of Italy and of Switzerland. But what happened was that Henry III, after the Emperor Henry III died, his son, Henry IV, found himself in a very difficult position in Germany, with many refusing to admit his authority. His father had become very important in Germany, and the dukes of the different areas didn't like to submit to him, and there wasn't anything they could do with his father. But once his son was in as a young man, they were unwilling to grant him the same leadership his father had. It's a long story of the strife and the difficulties there, but in the course of it, Gregory entered in. Great charges against Henry IV were brought to Gregory, who was then Pope, and Gregory excommunicated Henry IV. And then the enemies of Henry IV succeeded in persuading everybody that Henry IV was a wicked man, excommunicated by the Pope, deserving of condemnation, no longer to be considered as King of the Romans at all, and that and nearly all of his followers deserted him. And Henry Fort, they invited the Pope to come to Germany and to investigate the situation and decide between Henry Fort and his opponents who should be emperor. But Henry Fort had already Gregory had already excommunicated Henry Fort. And so Henry Fort, abandoned by most everybody, started for Rome as a pilgrim to try to confess before Gregory and get the excommunication removed. And Gregory started north in order to answer the request. He come to Germany and settle the matter. And they met when Gregory was at the castle of Canossa. And there in the cold, he was told that at the gate of the castle was Henry Fort seeking to confess his repentance before him and to plead for his forgiveness. And Gregory made Henry, the young emperor, stand barefooted in the cold for 3 days before he admitted him into the castle. And then after 3 days, in which the world saw the emperor barefoot and in rags standing before the castle pleading to be admitted by the Pope received him into the castle. Gregory bowed before him, confessed his sins, asked for forgiveness. Gregory raised him up, gave him full forgiveness, recognized him as a true son of the church, one who would have his support hereafter, and that became a figure for the next nearly 1,000 years of complete victory of the papal power over the power of the emperor. And when we think of Benedict IX, just a few years before, respected by nobody, then to go in this brief time to where Hildebrand could do such a thing as this to the one who was, by blood at least, the emperor, considered to be the great political leader of Europe. It was something that was constantly referred back to. Judgments of it today vary. Some think it shows the arrogance of the Pope. Others think it shows the weakness and kindness of the Pope, because they say that if he hadn't been such a kind-hearted man, he would have refused to receive Henry and would have gone up to Germany and investigated the facts and made his decision. Because the fact is that after the papal excommunication was renewed and Henry was admitted again to the Pope's favor, and even could say the Pope had fully forgiven him, then he managed to get people to his side again. And then when a new rebellion broke out against him, he was able to put it down. And then when people went with stories against him to the Pope, and the Pope excommunicated him again, he defied the excommunication and came with his troops right down to Rome, and Gregory fled to another place in Italy where he died, saying, "If I had not loved righteousness and hated iniquity, I would not now be dying as a refugee and a fugitive." But, of course, that does not so much remembered about Gregory VII, the end of it, as the dramatic scene at Canossa, where he asserted papal supremacy over the greatest political leader, at least in position, of the day. And Henry was in actual power later on, what he claimed to be then. So that this tremendous change in the papacy is something which was accomplished by the power of the German emperor, and never could have occurred without it, humanly speaking, but which also never could have occurred just by the power of the German emperor. It was the reformed spirit of Cluny and the many people with the attitude of Cluny of desiring that the spiritual power amount to something instead of just these political officers fighting against each other, which had become spread over a large part of Europe, and then it was the very clever and careful dealing of the monk Hildebrand, which made the change. And the change was one which, with various ups and downs, has continued to the present day. And so the power of the papacy has been varying in strength, but yet very great most of the time ever since. But I do not think it would have lasted. I think Benedict IX and John XII and
a dozen others nearly as bad would have brought into such disrespect that the whole idea would have disappeared if it were not for these forces which in this 11th century brought it back into a position in which to this very day it exerts tremendous influence over great multitudes of people. Now, capital C. Capital C is separation from the Eastern Church. Separation from the Eastern Church. Now, this is something the great importance of which at the time was not realized, but which later on, later ages, looked on this particular point as an epoch in the history. This is something which occurred in 1054. Hildebrand was the power in Rome, but Leo was the Pope. Leo IX was the Pope. And you will remember that when Chrysostom was exiled by the emperor about 400 or a year or two afterwards, that the Roman Church had broken relations with the East, had excommunicated the leaders of the church in Constantinople for the wickedness of the way they treated Chrysostom. And there were various times, off and on, during this period of 600 years, when for one reason or another, there was a break between the two places. The Bishop of Rome, except in the periods when the bishops of Rome were interested only in their own pleasure and the periods of great degradation, in the other periods, the bishops of Rome, as far as they dealt with the bishops of Constantinople, asserted their supremacy, that they were supreme as the descendants of Peter, while no apostle had founded the church at Constantinople. The bishops of Constantinople usually said, the bishop of Rome is supreme in the West, we are supreme in the East. But there was great difference about this, and there came differences about other matters between them. You remember the great iconoclastic controversy, which resulted in a big separation between them for a number of years. And then there was the matter of Photius, who took a very strong stand against the Romans, so strong that they have completely vilified him until recent years, when study of the facts have led them to admit that he was one of the wisest men and most able leaders in the Eastern Church all through the centuries. But finally, there was a big argument. Now that they got situation in Rome was improved, there came a big argument between it and the Bishop of Constantinople. And in this argument, the Greek church said, the Roman church is wrong in withdrawing the cup from the laity. Well, the Roman church said, this is the very body and blood of Christ. If you hand it to lay people, some of it may get spilled. And it's too much risk to take. So the priest must drink all of the wine in the communion. The laity only have the cracker. But the Greek church insisted that this was wrong. There were differences in various forms. One of the big things that irritated the Eastern Church was the fact that in the Western Church, the word filioque had been inserted into the creed, saying that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son instead of just from the Father. I don't think that this would have been such a great subject of argument if it were not for the fact that the West had inserted it in the creed on their own initiative, while the creed had been made at a supposedly ecumenical meeting at which most of the people were from the East. Now, if they had submitted to another meeting and said, investigate it and make a decision, that would have been one thing, but they simply inserted it and demanded it be kept there. And the East felt very keenly on that and gave that the most prominent position, until in 1054, the representatives of the Bishop of Rome placed a statement on the high altar in Constantinople that they were excommunicated. And representatives of the Eastern Bishop placed the statement in St. Peter's Church in Rome, they were excommunicated by them. And people thought this is just another in the succession of breaks, but it's one that has continued to the present day. And to the present day, the two have been distinct churches. distinct organizations, which for a period of 3 or 4 centuries kept calling each other excommunicated and hurling blasts against each other, but which in more recent years have simply admitted each to be a separate church, until finally Pope Paul went and embraced the one of the leaders in the Eastern Church and has tried to forget the differences, just be friends. And how far that will go is hard to say. But we'll have to continue there next Tuesday.